America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And top of the week to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Today is the day General Petraeus is going to be testifying before Congress. Tonight, he's giving an exclusive interview to Brit Hume over at Fox News. That should tell you something. And in the second hour of our program, I want to get into some depth about the questions that we really should be asking about this whole situation in Iraq and, you know, where we're going with this. I have what I think is a significant reframe that I think you will find fascinating. And hopefully will infiltrate, will make its way into both the Republican and Democratic discussions of the issue of Iraq. So we'll be doing that in the second hour of the program. In the third hour of the program, Jim Dean of Democracy for America, Howard's brother, and democracyforamerica.com is going to be with us, as well as Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union in our labor segment. Right now, Dan Gilbert is with us. He is a Republican presidential candidate in 2008. He's running in the primary. His website, We the People for President, FORPresident.com. And, Dan, welcome back to the program.
Okay, good to be back, Tom.
How's the campaign going?
Well, right now I'm up in Twin Mountain, New Hampshire, just talking to a group of people at a Chamber of Commerce here, and well-received. I'm glad things are going the way they are right now.
Good, good. You, on your website, WeThePeopleForPresident.com, and in your campaign, have been calling for the Republican Party to return to its roots, or roots, I guess, depending on what part of the country you're from, and talk again to its base. Tell me about that.
Well, what's happened is, and this happens to seems like all politicians that go to Washington D.C., they get involved with the lobbyists and the special interests, and they get swayed by what the lobbyists are telling them, and they lean to the left or they do special favors, and they're getting away from the original intent of the Constitution. And it's getting the conservative base very unhappy. The amnesty bill, which some people call it the comprehensive immigration bill, but that was the straw that broke the camel's back for a lot of conservatives. They are just extremely...
Well, that busted up. Yeah, that blew up John McCain's campaign, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. He's got a strong following up here in New Hampshire, and I don't understand why they would be for him because of his stance on the First Amendment, like the McCain-Feingold bill, and the immigration issue. But he does have some following up here.
Yeah, interesting. So let's talk about the historic stance of the Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party was founded in Jackson, Michigan, as I recall, in June of 1856. Its first presidential candidate was its first serious presidential candidate was Abraham Lincoln, and he won. And he was the first president to defend the right of strikers, of organized labor to strike. He stopped police and private police in Chicago from breaking up a union demonstration and supported the right to strike. He was a champion of civil liberties of the Constitution. The Republican platform of 1872, I have actually a copy of the Republican platform of 1872. And this was when the Republican Party was still essentially the original Republican Party. And let me just toss a couple quotes at you, and I'd like to get your take on how they comport with today's Republican Party. For example, they didn't think that somebody should be appointed to office just because he was a political hack or the son of the Secretary of State. They said, quote, "Any system of civil service under which the subordinate positions of the government are considered rewards for mere party zeal is fatally demoralizing, and we therefore favor reform of the system by laws which shall abolish the evils of patronage and make honesty, efficiency, and fidelity the essential qualifications for public positions." Wasn't that Bill Clinton's way of, I mean, you know, he put the most qualified guy in charge of FEMA, not his largest donor. In the Bush administration, we find right across the board from EPA to FEMA to a dozen other agencies that the people who gave the most money to the Republican Party or who are most loyal to the Bush family have been given high positions and not the most competent.
Well, I wouldn't say it just happened to Bush, and maybe Clinton did put people in office that he thought were most qualified. But
yeah, he put a Republican in as Secretary of Defense.
Well, that's true. But this has been going on for decades. That people who donate, they have a heads up. They have a strong interest in what they're giving for, and so the candidate rewards them. And it's not fair, and it's not good for the country that somebody's put in office just because they donate money.
Yeah. Okay. So you agree with the traditional Republican stance. Here's another one. This is from the Republican platform of 1872. They didn't think that big corporations should get the kind of treatment that and freebies that big corporations get today. They said, quote, "We are opposed to further grants of public land or federal assets to corporations and monopolies and demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people." They didn't want any more land to be given to the railroads. They wanted land, as land was acquired, either to be put into national parks or to be given to the people. Well, actually, national parks came along with Teddy Roosevelt, to be given to people for homesteading.
Well,
they were essentially anti-corporate.
Right, and which was good back then. But what's happened now is we don't have the railroads controlling things like they used to, but we do have big business. And I think that's what happened when we did the NAFTA thing back in 1994. And now we have these Mexican truckers coming across the border started last Thursday, and they can go anywhere in the country without any rules or restrictions or any controls on them. And so that's one of the reasons I've sent out an op-ed piece, I don't know if you got it yet, that says we need to repeal NAFTA. It's dangerous for our national security, and NAFTA was the one that ordered us to do that. And we should not have a Mexican, a Canadian, an American telling the Bush administration, or for any administration for that matter, what we have to do to comply with a treaty or an agreement like that.
Yeah, I think most Democrats would probably agree with that too, Dan. I think you're transcending politics a little bit here.
Well, I hope so. You know, you started your program talking about freedom and all that stuff. Mm. I'm for the same thing. It's just the means that we get, the way we get there may be a little bit different, but we are all after the same thing, the best thing for our children and the best thing for our country. It's just how we get there is the problem.
And that's the thing that we have to keep in mind, I think, is that we're all Americans here. We're talking with Dan Gilbert. WeThePeopleForPresident.com is website. He's a candidate for president in the Republican primaries here. The Republicans of 1872 felt that the best way to raise funds and to protect domestic industries was by tariffs. They wrote in their platform, their national party platform, "The nation's annual revenue after paying current expenditures, pensions, and the interest on the public debt should furnish a moderate balance for the reduction of the principal of the national debt, and revenue should be raised by duties upon importations, the details of which duties should be so adjusted as to aid in securing remunerative wages to labor."
Boy, times have changed.
This was pretty much the policy of the United States right up until Reagan became president. It certainly was what Dwight Eisenhower did.
Well, you know, there are certain industries that we need to protect because we have to maintain our national security. We have to be able to build weapons for our army. And we have to maintain some industrial base. What's happened is, with this NAFTA thing, the industrial base has been shipped off to Mexico. We've had, in North and South Carolina, we've had hundreds and hundreds of factories closed and the equipment moved to Mexico. And then you have the outsourcing of manufacturing going to China, and then you have the outsourcing of the customer service going to India.
So how do we bring it back if not with tariffs? That seems like the most rational way to do it to me.
Well, one of the ways to do it is to do away with NAFTA. That will bring
which would put us back into a tariff-based trade system, wouldn't it?
Well, no. What's happening is the big business is expecting the American consumer to continue to buy these cheap products that were made with Mexican labor or Chinese labor, but yet they're closing the factories and the American
right. But I mean, those things are only cheap because they're being brought into the United States without an import tariff. It used to be that if you made a pair of shoes in the United States with $1 worth of labor, you made that same pair of shoes in Mexico with 20 cents worth of labor, we charged 80 cent import tax, so that wherever you made them, your labor costs were essentially the same. It protected labor. It kept shoe manufacturing in the United States. In fact, it's the only reason we made shoes in this country for 200 years. We don't make shoes in this country anymore for all practical purposes.
Right.
I mean, why not go back to that?
Well, I think it's a dangerous situation because of the global market that we have. That would ruin the market for our goods. So there has to be a balance on what we do and what we charge tariffs on and what we ship out.
Okay. Dan Gilbert, WeThePeopleForPresident.com, the website, the traditional values of the Republican Party. Dan, thanks for being with us today.
Good luck. Thanks. See you. Bye, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
I'm hearing nothing. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, the Republican platform of 1872. You know, it's really my message to Republicans today. Please take back your party. I'm telling you, Dwight Eisenhower is rolling in his grave. Teddy Roosevelt rolling in his grave. Abraham Lincoln rolling in his grave. The Republicans of 1872, all in favor of the Bill of Rights. The Republican Party proposes, this is from the platform, the election of 1872, the Republican Party proposes to respect the rights reserved by the people to themselves as carefully as the powers delegated to them by the states and federal government. It disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purpose of removing evils by interference with rights not surrendered by the people to either the state or national government. Now, if that isn't the Republican Party repudiating Gonzalez and Bush and Cheney, I don't know what is. Republicans, take back your party. They also were at the Republican Party in 1872 is also in favor of women's rights. This in the platform, the Republican Party is mindful of its obligation. This was before women had the right to vote legally at the federal level. And I think by that time, most states had outlawed the women voting. There was women could vote in some states at the founding of this country, but throughout the early 1800s, states started turning that off. The Republican Party is mindful of its obligations to the loyal women of America for their noble devotion to the cause of freedom. Their admission to wider fields of usefulness is viewed with satisfaction. In other words, they should be able to work. And the honest demand of any class of citizens for additional rights should be treated with respectful consideration. And then they wrapped it up. This is from the Republican platform, 1872. They said, "We believe the people will not entrust the government to any party or combination of men composed chiefly of those who have resisted every step of beneficent progress." They had it. Amazing. Now we're finding, now we have Republicans who have nothing to do with the historic Republican positions about civil rights. The historic, it's just the Republican Party, Nixon with his Southern strategy, the Republican Party saw that some of the racist elements of the Democratic Party, which had really picked up steam in the 1830s, 1840s, and after the Civil War, the Democratic Party of the South was basically in large part, the old Confederacy, or the elements of it. And so Lyndon Johnson said, that's it. The party, we the party and the nation, is going to cut loose these Southern racist Democrats. And he was advised very explicitly that if he signed the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act in 1967, that he would lose that the Democratic Party would lose the South for a generation. And he said it's a price worth paying. And he signed the legislation. And sure enough, Richard Nixon comes along and says, hey, we got to have a Southern strategy here. We got to pick up these racist voters. Let's bring them into the party. Let's make them part of the action. And so you have a Republican Party now that has been, since the 1880s, I mean, within 8 years of the platform that I've shared with you, the Republican Party had been taken over by the railroads, the steel companies, the oil companies, by Andrew Carnegie, by John D. Rockefeller, by Jay Gould, by basically the robber barons they were referred to as at the time. The Republican Party taken over by them, and to this day. And up until the 1980s, everybody in America understood it. The Republicans were the party of the fat cats. They represented inherited wealth and corporate power. And the Democrats were the party of the people, and they represented labor and the right to work and the average person. Everybody understood that. And then Lewis Powell came up with this memo back in, as I recall, the late 60s, maybe early 70s. It was just before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. In a letter that he wrote to the American Chamber of Commerce, and he said, we've got to expand our base. The war of ideas is what has to be won, and we need to change the thinking of America. And you guys, business, should coordinate your efforts and lead the charge. And business, which up till that point had been largely uninvolved with politics, became very involved with politics. The number of lobbyists exploded. Think tanks started. The Heritage Foundation was founded. The Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, all these think tanks, the Brookings Institution at Stanford, the Hoover Institute at Stanford, rather, the Brookings Institute, all of these think tanks were generated that would put out these conservative memes and that would promote the interests of inherited wealth and corporate power. And at the same time, they knew that they couldn't win elections on that. And so they reached out to the religious right. And Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and friends were willing to make a deal with the devil. In this case, the corporate Republican Party. The money changers in the temple, they were willing to make a deal with them in exchange for political power and money. George Bush last year gave $1 billion to, quote, faith-based initiatives to churches. You know, mind-boggling. They made a deal with the devil and they said, we'll bring our people along and we will reinvent the Republican Party. And we'll put a patina on it, a veneer of family values and religion. But really, it's pandering to racism and fear in order to promote the economic interests of the true owners of the Republican Party. And I say the only solution is for Republicans to take back their party. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Just give us some truth. Speaking of the Republican debate, or the Republican base, excuse me, the debased Republican base. This from the wire services, as they say, demanding further intervention from the Federal Reserve to protect their endangered fortunes. Thousands of the nation's leading hedge fund managers marched on Washington today. Dubbed the Million Mercedes March, the protest was said to be the largest chauffeur-driven demonstration in the Capitol's history. Limousines started jamming the streets of Washington at approximately 10 this morning as irate hedge fund owners converged in front of the Federal Reserve building to demand stronger action to protect their imperiled riches. Chanting, no rate cut, no peace. The furious money managers were pepper sprayed by police as their protests threatened to take a violent turn. Tracy Klugian, a hedge fund manager from Greenwich, Connecticut, said that simmering anger in the hedge fund community was a powder keg waiting to explode. Mr. Klugian said, we have yet to see the ripple effects of this crisis. When these guys have to freeze their trophy wives' shopping allowances, there's going to be hell to pay. Mr. Klugian's words seemed almost prophetic as a mob of angry trophy wives looted a Ralph Lauren boutique in East Hampton, New York, later in the day, stripping the establishment of its entire fall collection. If the Fed fails to intervene, Mr. Klugian warned, an ugly situation among the nation's wealthiest money managers will only get uglier. He said, a lot of these guys are mad as hell right now, but wait until they're down to their last billion. With a tip of the hat and thanks to Andy Borowitz, that actually from the BorowitzReport.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and say hi. I hang out there during the breaks, and you know, no fees, no whatever. I mean, it's just, it's a great place, nice place to hang out. There's also a message board over at TomHartmann.com, and, of course, our blog at AirAmerica.com. Tony in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Tom, I have an issue with you when you say, keep saying, Republicans, take back your party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel this party is completely, completely on the wrong foundation, you know?
The Republican Party.
Yeah, it's like telling kids.
Yeah, that's my point, too.
Why don't you tell them, you know what, come to our side, you know? We have the solution. Rather than telling them...
Consider for a minute. Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican president of the United States. He thought that the top, that if you earned over $3.2 million in today's income, you should pay a 91% income tax. He believed that labor should be protected by the Department of Labor and had a Department of Labor that prosecuted employers who tried to break up people who wanted to start unions. He believed that Social Security should be strong and should be protected, and he believed ultimately that we should have a balanced budget. He believed that we should not have wars in foreign countries. In fact, he campaigned in 1952 on the platform of ending the war in Korea, which he did. He ended the war in Korea. I mean, he was in favor of peace. He believed that the military-industrial complex was a threat to America. And in 1960, when he was leaving office, his departing speech was, beware of the military-industrial complex. Republicans need to return to that moderate Republican base. You know, I think Democrats need to return to their progressive base as well. And that's, you know, the theme of probably 90% of my shows. But today I had a Republican on, so I thought, you know, let's talk about this. You know, that's the Republican Party that my dad grew up in. That's the Republican Party that a lot of people still remember and think should come back. What has happened is since Reagan, the Republican Party has been rehijacked by the wealthy elites and the corporate powers of this country, and they brought into the fold since Nixon the racists from the South, and they've been playing basically on racism, and that's the undercurrent in the Republican debate on immigration, and homophobia, fear and hatred of the other, and that's no way to run a party.
And you think innocent Republicans like your dad are going to take back a party that is entrenched with the limbos and all the bigots out there and the wealthy elites who have entrenched interests to perpetrate wars? You think these guys are going to take it back?
Hope springs eternal, Tony. I know that there are a lot of Republicans who are talking like this. Some of them are simply leaving. I mean, Chuck Hagel has decided he's going to leave the party. John Warner's leaving the party, or, you know, leaving office, I mean, for all practical purposes, essentially leaving the party as well. Jim Jeffords, when I lived in Vermont, Jim Jeffords was our Republican senator from Vermont. He left the party altogether. He said, I haven't changed. I'm still the same Republican I was in 1955. He said, but my party has changed. And I think it's time that we reach out to Republicans of goodwill. And there are some out there. There are people who are Republicans of goodwill and say, why don't you guys take back your party?
Well, my way of reaching out is take them out of a sinking boat and put them in your boat, you know? Let it die, you know?
Yeah, join us in the Democratic Party or join us as independents or join us in the Greens. Tony, good point. Thank you very much for the call and well said. 1-866-303-2270. Steve in Monterey, California. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Tom, thanks. Welcome back. We lost you off Potatoes, progressive host. And welcome back. Your screeners are 100% better.
Thank you, Steve. We're really pleased to be back on KRXA Live in Monterey. I know they had a listener contest and said, you know, what host do you want to hear live? And apparently, you know, we did very, very well. And a tip of the hat to all the folks at KRXA and all the listeners at KRXA in Monterey. We're very pleased. Today is the first day that we're back live on that station. And thanks a lot for the call and for the welcome back. Richard in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Richard, provocative question, nationalism?
You've expressed yourself as a nationalist before, and I kind of know the answer to the question, but do you think, can you tell me if you believe America is better than any other country?
No.
It sounds like you do, because you don't...
But I do believe that America is better than any other country for me, because I grew up here, I understand this country, I feel a part of this country, It's in my blood. I lived in Germany for a year. I was astounded by the culture shock. I thought I was basically going to be moving to a country just like America where they just spoke a different language. And what I discovered is that it's really a culture shock is just an amazing thing. How different the cultures are. I think that at our core, we all have this basic human instinct to have family, to have tribe, to have community, and to have nation. And I think that we are all, whether we like it or not, and whether we want to identify it or not, are at a certain level nationalists. And frankly, that impulse is the impulse also that drives racism. And I think that we're all racists at a certain level as well. But that's nothing to brag about. And the point is to identify it, to own it, and then to make it a good force rather than a bad force. I mean, German nationalism is what led to Nazism. On the other hand, Swedish nationalism is what led to a state that, is a very, very good place to live. Belief that, hey, this is our country, we're going to make it the very best place we can, rather than being an anti-nationalist and saying, no, we're going to just throw the borders open, we're going to let multinational corporations run the country, which is George Bush Sr.'s idea, Reagan's idea, George Bush Jr.'s idea, and Bill Clinton's idea. They want to surrender our sovereignty to the World Trade Organization. I think that's a mistake.
I agree. I don't know if I've driven through Portland and Vancouver, and you notice the Ron Paul supporters out there with their signs. Do you notice that they're in their 20s?
These are people, they're not politically sophisticated. They're people who don't understand what the implications would be of a libertarian running the country.
I think they understand exactly what the implications are of reelecting the Democrats and the Republicans, because if you notice, Democrats share their nationalism with Republicans.
Some extent. Again, we have to be careful of the definition of nationalism, because there is a really evil and dark side to nationalism, and there is a really positive side to, for lack of a better word, nationalism. The problem is we don't have a positive word to identify that. What I'm suggesting is that there is a positive dimension to nationalism.
Well, I don't believe it's a positive implication that America has been expanding ever since Jefferson in purchase of his Louisiana territory and the annexation of Hawaii.
But see, that's not nationalism, in my opinion. That's not nationalism. That's imperialism. That's expansionism. I mean, there's other words that you can use to describe that.
Imperialism that we've killed millions upon millions of Asians when we took over the Philippines in 1898. And 20-year-olds who support Ron Paul recognize that, and we can't go on, Tom. We can't go on with this.
No, I agree. I agree. There are, the idea of, reaching across the world and saying, okay, we know what's best. And this is, by the way, Richard, what is implicit in the whole Iraq debate right now. And this is, what's so bizarre about it is we're debating how should we help them run their country. Say what? I think that they know how to run their country. They've been doing it for 7,000 years. They know how to build their country. They've been doing it for 7,000 years. I mean, the oldest civilization, the oldest written civilization that we know of, arguably the Indians would argue that the Vedas go back more than 7,000 years. I think it probably pretty much all emerged about the same time, is, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest written story, which is from 7,000 years ago and was written in Ur, a city now largely extinct, a city that was about 100 miles north of Baghdad. I mean, this is the most ancient of civilizations. So anyway, for us to sit around and say, oh, we know what's best for them, or we should control that territory or that. See, that's, as I said, that's the dark side of nationalism. And I do not embrace that or claim it or hold it up or endorse it in any way. And that's why I'm very wary of saying that I'm a nationalist without a whole lot of explanation, just like I'd be very wary of saying I'm a socialist without a whole lot of explanation. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Bill, who's gonna pay the bill. Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
Yeah, we have three Republican presidents, Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bush Jr., who have run up 70% of the of all of the debt in the 230-year history of the United States in order to stimulate the economy and make it look like their insane conservative economic policies are good for America, but they're really running it on a credit card and dumping the debt on us and on future generations. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's time for the Republicans to repudiate this kind of insane behavior and take back their party. Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi. You know, I really think your show is very appropriate today because as a 68-year-old Democrat who's voted a straight ticket my whole life, I'm seriously considering quitting the party and becoming a Republican because clearly the Democrats are incapable of doing anything about it. Maybe if we all move over and take over the party, we can pull it to the center and at least get something done as Republicans.
It's possible, yeah.
I mean, the Democrats. I look at what happened 6 months ago. When I mean, I've never been angry at my party in my life. I look at this historic moment where Nancy Pelosi becomes the first woman Speaker of the House in history and has this opportunity to become a statesman or stateswoman, if you will, and to make a serious change. And Harry Reid has a chance, even in spite of the problem with the filibuster situation, to stand up and put his foot down and say, no, no, no. And instead, they're all cowering under their desks, while Bush, I mean, I can't get mad at Bush anymore. He's like the dog that poops on your lawn, you know? It's like he's doing what dogs do. I'm mad at the owners holding on to his leash who are not yanking him off my property.
Yeah. No, Frank, your point is well made, and there are many of us who are very concerned about the Democratic Party's lack of spine and lack of speaking out. I think it's a real tragedy. I had dinner, or I sat next to at a fundraising dinner, a Democratic member of Congress about a month and a half ago. Actually, it was the week after, 2 weeks after the vote to give Bush more funding for Iraq. And he said, do you have any idea why Congress's poll numbers are lower than Bush's? And I said, yeah, because you guys voted to give Bush the money. And he's like, you really think that's it? And I'm like, yeah, I really think that's it. I'm telling you, that's the bottom line. Dan in Michigan. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to, I know this is a little off topic, but I wanted to address this Bin Laden tape and the accusations from people like Sean Hannity that Democrats sound like Bin Laden.
Or vice versa. Yeah.
Right. And I guess, you know, some kind of stuck in my mind over the weekend while I was thinking about this. If Bin Laden wants us out of Iraq, why would he discredit the very people that would withdraw us from Iraq by parroting their position? You know, I mean, he's
right. No, Bin Laden's very best friend is George W. Bush. George W. Bush has given Bin Laden everything he wanted. Bin Laden wanted us to attack an Arab nation so that he could say to the world, "See, I told you these guys hate Muslims." And Bush did it. Bin Laden wanted to remain free. Bush helped him remain free. Bin Laden wanted to have himself elevated to the status of Lex Luthor, you know, the supervillain. Bush elevated him to the status of Lex Luthor. Bin Laden did not want to be pursued by international police forces, and he was not pursued by international police forces. George W. Bush gave Bin Laden absolutely everything he wanted, and Bin Laden is returning the favor, and did return the favor just before the 2004 election, if that tape was you know, real. And I'm sure we'll continue to do everything he can to help the Republican Party.
Yes, he's absolutely he's a surrogate right now, and he's discrediting the left in order to help the Republicans.
That's right. Bin Laden and Bush are two sides of the same coin. They both can only survive on fear and war and hatred, and they need each other. They absolutely need each other. Without Bin Laden, Bush is nothing. Before 9/11, George Bush was viewed as this president who really wasn't president. The Supreme Court made him president. You know, nobody much liked him. He was talking about, you know, weird stuff like he's going to run the country like a corporation. And nobody was much taking him seriously. And then 9/11 happens. And all of a sudden, now Bush gets to play Superman because he has a Lex Luthor. And he did everything he could to elevate that Lex Luthor, and then he turned Saddam into a Lex Luthor, and then he defeated Saddam, and although, you know, Iraq is still there. But, yeah, absolutely, it's a symbiotic relationship. And that's something that you're not going to find the mainstream media touching. Instead, they'd rather use the Republican talking points against the Democrats. I mean, I was boggled. I turned on Meet the Press this weekend, and here's to have a discussion about the Democratic candidates. Tim Russert has on the guy who's the correspondent for the Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network, and some Republican weasel. I mean, he's got a couple of right wingers sitting there regurgitating right wing talking points in the context of discussing the Democratic candidates. It was pathetic. I am astounded. Tim Russert, I mean, this was the most pathetic low in American journalism that I have ever seen. I was astounded that Tim Russert would do something so craven and so twisted. Steve in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Steve, we got a little less than a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. Is it a quick one?
Yeah. Wasn't it the first Republican president that suspended habeas corpus in time of war?
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln. But the Constitution specifically says that during time of rebellion, habeas corpus can be suspended. And Lincoln then went back to Congress and asked for ratification of that. So he was within the boundaries of the Constitution. Bush is suspending habeas corpus, and we have not been invaded. There are, you know, we're not occupied. We have not had a rebellion. So it's a very different thing.
Well, when we're looking back, you know, we should look at the pictures, warts and all, and perhaps look for a new paradigm in the 21st century instead of trying to resurrect the 19th or the 20th.
Yeah, I don't disagree entirely. On the other hand, there are a lot of good things in the history of this country that we need to be looking back at and we need to be understanding. In the context of Iraq, though, and I want to get into this the next hour. In fact, I'm going to open the next hour with this. We are asking the wrong questions, and we are having the wrong discussion. And until we change the questions in the discussion, nothing positive is going to happen. Let me share that with you right after the news.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Imagine that a major city in America were to fall apart somehow. In fact, let's take two major cities. Let's take Detroit and San Francisco. Massive destruction, damaging most of the homes. Let's say in San Francisco it's an earthquake, and in Detroit it's a tornado. Wipes out the city. Electricity cut off, electric wires down, phone systems taken out. People are dazed, they're in shock and awe. Prisons are damaged, and thousands of criminals are spill out onto the streets and melt back into the civilian population. Massive destruction. The federal government then responds. Now, just consider this for a moment. I mean, this is a fantasy, right? This is just consider this little fiction story. The federal government then responds. They put up a wall around the city, around each city, around Detroit and San Francisco, and take down the state and local governments. They fire all the police. They fire the fire department. They prevent the state, because the state doesn't exist anymore, from paying for the doctors in the hospitals. They throw up cordons around each city to prevent nearby communities from coming in to help. Why? Because the president of the United States, in this mythical story, believes in a mythical force. It's called the free market. And he believes that if he gets all the government stuff out of the way in Detroit and San Francisco, now that these cities have been damaged so badly, if he can get all of the government out of the way, that the free market will magically and automatically rebuild these cities. The president declares that instead of paying normal taxes and getting normal services, nobody will any longer get any services from the government. No Social Security payments, no food stamps, no Medicare, no Medicaid. All the big government programs are ended, and they're replaced, and the tax is replaced with a 15% flat tax to pay for the barest of services like rebuilding the police force. There's an elimination of all the regulations on corporate actions, whether it's local corporations or multinational corporations. All the rules are thrown out. Unions are outlawed. The 200 largest companies in each city, in Detroit and San Francisco, the 200 largest companies, and thus the largest employers, are shut down because they've been running inefficiently and are now for sale for any transnational corporation who wants them. Problem is, everybody who's working there is now unemployed, and so far none of the transnational corporations are showing any interest. So things start to get bad. Things start to get ugly. People start protesting. So, again, consistent with the president's belief that the only legitimate function of government is a military one, police and army. As people are protesting in Detroit and San Francisco, he brings 20,000 troops into each city. But the people are unemployed. Those with enough assets to do so have already fled the cities forever. They've moved to other undamaged cities in America. And so the remaining people are those who don't have enough money to flee the city. And they're having a hard time getting gas for their cars. They only have sporadic electricity. They're finding themselves the victims of waterborne disease because the government-run water treatment facilities have been abandoned on the assumption that the free market will take care of their water needs. And they're the victims of the recently freed criminals. People are looting stores, looking for things that they can sell or, you know, in order to deal with the fact that they're unemployed, they're broke. At first, the people just protest in the streets, demanding a return of their jobs, their water and electricity, and some federal money so the remnants of the local construction companies can begin rebuilding their cities. But the president, believing in his mythical free market, orders his soldiers to suppress the demonstration, and soldiers shoot and actually kill some of the protesters because they can't tell the difference between the protesters and the criminals. The people fight back. They start shooting at the soldiers. The president declares martial law, and in the background brings in John Negroponte, a black ops specialist who is alleged to have helped organize death squads in Central America to funnel guns and training to professional hitmen to take out those citizens of the two cities who may have any history of political dissent. Within weeks, bodies of young men with their hands tied behind their backs and bullets in the back of their heads begin to show up in the streets of Detroit and San Francisco. The people of the rest of America, the surrounding regions, they want to know what the president is going to do for San Francisco and Detroit. He says that cities occupied by his military forces will soon be pacified if we'll just give him a little more time, more troops, more tanks and bullets. Any discussion of the return of normal government, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security payments, free health care, public education, water, electricity, food stamps, discussion of any of these things is totally absent from the news media, which is owned by big corporations who agree with the president's belief that the mythical free market will solve everything eventually. Meanwhile, the people in Detroit and San Francisco are not only fighting the army, they're fighting among themselves. They're breaking into enclaves, black and white, Asian, Hispanic, rich, poor. Neighborhoods are creating their own militias to protect themselves. They're shooting on sight anybody who looks different, who enters their territory. Religious leaders emerge as the only leaders, filling the power vacuum that's left by the destruction of government, and churches and mosques and synagogues become the pretty much the only centers where people can find food, shelter, and an authority figure who can resolve local disputes. The president, noticing this, declares these local religious figures insurgents and orders his military to find them and arrest them. The military is meanwhile coming under increasing attack from local people who are angry because they're getting progressively less and less water, electricity, and food. Two-thirds of all the doctors in San Francisco and Detroit have fled the cities, along with most of the wealthy, the middle class, the upper middle class. And the hospitals destroyed in the tornado in Detroit and the earthquake in San Francisco haven't been rebuilt because the mythical free market, it doesn't seem to be working. Local contractors want to help out and put people back to work, but they're forbidden from getting federal money. Their workers remain unemployed. So the president hires some friends of his from Texas to go into Detroit and San Francisco to rebuild the cities using out-of-town or even out-of-country labor. And all the money from doing this, the federal money from doing this, goes back to Texas, to the president's buddies. Well, the locals in San Francisco and Detroit who want a job, they resent this, and they begin shooting at the contractors as well. The insurgency is now well underway. The president pleads with the American people for a few more $1 billion to pay for his military operations and to pay for his Texas contractors. His generals tell us how they've pacified parts of Grosse Pointe and Dearborn and Detroit and Nob Hill in San Francisco. They're now under our control. The U.S. House and Senate are torn apart between a desire to pull out the soldiers who are dying in increasing numbers and those who believe we must first pacify the insurgents in Detroit and San Francisco. Unable to reach a consensus, and with a general loyalty to the president pushing for more time and money to pacify Detroit and San Francisco, Congress votes another few $1 billion for the president and gives him some more time. Meanwhile, the president's advisors keep telling him if he can just wait long enough, this magical free market is going to solve all the problems in Detroit and San Francisco. Eventually, transnational corporations will see the huge and cheap labor force in the cities, which are now totally impoverished, as an asset. The 15% flat tax will bring prosperity. The privatization of Social Security, medical services, and schools will bring opportunity to the people in these two cities. Just wait. It'll happen. The only solution allowed for discussion in the media is the military solution. After all, we have to win back Detroit and San Francisco from the insurgents. We have to kill off those engaging in racial, religious, regional, or sectarian violence. And sure enough, as neighborhoods reorganize themselves by race and ethnicity, as the young protesters are killed off and the local religious leaders take over the functions of government, them providing education, health care, even food and safe water, the violence actually begins to subside in those localities. The president goes on national TV along with some of his generals and says these reductions in local violence are proof that his military strategy to pacify Detroit and San Francisco is showing progress. And so for another year, the nation votes for more military funds, waiting for the magical free market solution to take hold, forgetting the lesson of 7,000 years of city-state civilization. The public services, progressive taxes, and local government are necessary to a civil and functional society. Lest you've forgotten, the main reason why the Bush administration had no plan B for Iraq is because they believed that within 3 months of our invasion, the free market would solve all problems in that country. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Oh, there's a lot we can do. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Once again, I just shared, if you're just tuning in, just shared a quick story, a little fictional story about Detroit being taken out by a tornado, San Francisco being taken out by an earthquake, and the president deciding that the appropriate response is to let the free market solve the problem. Cut everybody's income taxes to a flat 15% income tax. Do away with Social Security. Make unions illegal. Sell off the 200 largest companies in each city, or put them up for sale, shut them down and put them up for sale. Disband the police and fire departments on the assumption that privatized ones will emerge in their place. Privatize the schools, stop paying for schools, stop all the food stamp programs, stop offering food to people. Just back out, get out of the way. and do the only thing that conservatives believe government should do, which is provide military force. And so he puts 20,000 troops into each city to keep order. And pretty soon, the people who are unemployed and who are hungry and who are broke, the rich people have fled, right? They've left. They took their money and ran. And everybody else is starting to get pretty damn angry, and they're shooting back at the soldiers. And now we have an insurgency in Detroit and San Francisco. And so the president starts asking for more money for the military and more troops. He needs a surge. And Congress gives it to him. And at the same time, in these two cities, you find that local neighborhoods are actually starting to get their act together. Principally as a result of local churches, the last remaining institution. Now the government's been wiped out. Churches, synagogues, mosques. And ethnic cleansing is happening. Black people living in white areas, white people living in black areas, Hispanics living in Asian areas, Asians living in white areas, blah, 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 blah. People are starting to push people out or kill them off. And enclaves are forming. And as these cities balkanize, the violence goes down. And the president says, see, my military solution is working. And you hear this story and you go, this is friggin' nuts. This is crazy. Who would ever do such a thing? That's exactly what we did in Iraq. We had a very successful war. We took, it was illegal, but it was successful. When Bush stood on that aircraft carrier and said that the war is over.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
So on May 1st, 2003, we won the war. The war was over. Then began the occupation. And when we began the occupation of Japan and Germany and the rest of Europe, for that matter, after World War II, what we did was we said, you know, the most important institution that we can create is government. And, you know, government that will assist the rebuilding of its own nation, government that will protect labor. And so we helped them write constitutions. We helped them create governments that protected the rights of labor. Unions, union organizations that put into place a pension and social security program that provided food for people who were unemployed, that provided unemployment payments for people and housing for people who were unemployed, that provided money to local contractors to rebuild the nation at the local level from the ground up. We did it through government. And it worked. And the neocons wanted a blank slate, a tabula rasa. They wanted to be able to say, we're going to start from zero here in Iraq. And they were so certain that the free market, rather than government, would solve all the problems that they banned government and banned labor unions, imposed a 15% flat tax in Iraq, shut down the 200 largest companies in Iraq because they happened to be owned by the government, expecting that the next day American companies were going to come in and bid on them. But these were old, inefficient industries. Who wants them? Throwing millions of people out of work. We did away with their social security system. We did away with their disability system for widows and orphans. We did away with their subsidies for higher education. It was privatized. We did away with their free national health care program. Two-thirds of the doctors fled the country. We did not provide them with the money to rebuild their water and their electric. Instead, we said, oh, we'll bring in Texas companies, good buddies of George Bush. All the money will go back to Texas, and they're going to hire people from Sri Lanka to work here because it's cheaper than local Iraqis. And by the way, the only solution to all this is military. And that's the debate that is happening right now in Congress. That's the testimony of Petraeus. I find it mind-boggling that all across America, all of the media is discussing whether or not we need more military to solve a problem, which is not a military problem. It's a social problem. It's an economic problem. It's a problem that traditionally would be solved by government. But these guys are so anti-government.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
These guys are so anti-government, they're unwilling to even consider that. The only function that they believe government should have is the military. And so we're going to spend more military. We're asking the wrong question. It's not, do we need more troops or fewer troops? It's how much money should we be giving the Iraqis to jumpstart their own indigenous construction industry to rebuild their own nation? How much is the Marshall Plan for Iraq going to cost? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
One of the folks in our chat room says it's just started raining in New York. So there you go. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, the free market will solve all problems. All problems. You see, there was this house in New Rochelle. It had been on the market for $750,000. Owned by a couple of mortgage brokers who are apparently now out of work. They dropped the price all the way down to $600,000, still hadn't sold. So, New Rochelle police raided the place Friday. Why? They turned it into a brothel! The house, they say, had been turned into a brothel, complete with heavy shades over all the windows and a red ribbon placed out by the sidewalk to indicate they were open for business. One of the couple's Pleasantville neighbors, this, by the way, from CBS News, one of the couple's Pleasantville neighbors seemed pretty sure business problems were at the root of the shocking news. Peter Pasadomo said, I know they're mortgage brokers, and I know it's been a tough business, so I assume they have had some financial difficulty. Both homeowners, as well as the four alleged prostitutes who range in age from 21 to 30, are free on bail. So, see, ultimately, the free market solves all problems, right? You know, it's the solution to the mortgage problem. Everybody become a prostitute. That's actually what happens. You know, very, very, very poor countries where they don't have a strong social safety net, you find the exploitation largely of women through prostitution to be rampant. So General Petraeus is testifying as we speak. And what I want to say is he's the wrong guy. Not he's the wrong guy because he's going to put out Bush administration BS about how wonderful everything is going. It's because we're asking the wrong question. The question shouldn't be, how do we stop violence in Iraq with military force? The question should be, how do we rebuild Iraq so that people will go back to work and stop being insurgents? Because the people that we're calling insurgents right now used to be called barbers and dentists and teachers and civil servants. They used to be called gas station operators. They used to be called couriers. They used to be called clerks and secretaries and salespeople. And now we call them insurgents because their jobs are gone. Because even in the reconstruction of Iraq, by giving it to these big Texas corporations and having them bring in people from Sri Lanka and Bangladesh to do the work, none of that money is ending up in the hands of the Iraqis. They're out of work. If we were going to have a general testify, it should be a general in the mold of George Marshall, who understood these things, who understood that armies are designed to kill people and break things, and that after you're done killing people and breaking things, after you have taken out a government, which we did in just a couple of weeks, back in 2003, after you're done with that, then you move to the second phase, which is not a military occupation. It may be necessary short term to replace the police infrastructure that has been shattered, but primarily to rebuild the infrastructure of the nation, the civil infrastructure, so that people to rebuild the communities, to rebuild the jobs, to rebuild the factories, to rebuild the cities and the streets, to rebuild the civil infrastructure. And nobody is talking about this. I find this incredible. No talking heads on TV. Well, how long is it going to take us to rebuild Iraq? Instead, the question is, how long is it going to take Halliburton to rebuild? And we're discovering that the work that Halliburton is doing and all these other contractors, it's falling apart. Four-fifths of it is unusable within 6 months of the time they're done. Why? Because they're doing it on the cheap. Why are they doing it on the cheap? Because it's profitable. And where is the profit going? It's all coming back to the United States. This is how Bush is stimulating our economy, is by having our companies over when he should be stimulating their economy. If you want to follow the story, even Democrats like Brian Barrett, are saying, you know, we broke it. We have an obligation to fix it. Okay, if you want to follow that story, you don't fix it with the Army. You fix it with a Marshall Plan. I mean, obviously, it's a discussion we should have had 4 years ago, but it's still not too late. We should not be listening to Petraeus about whether or not the surge, the escalation is being successful. No, what we should be talking to are civil engineers. We should be talking to experts in governance. How do you rebuild a government? How do you rebuild local governments? How do you prevent people like Muqtada al-Sadr from stepping into the void created by our blowing up and destroying all the instruments of local government? How do you do away with Paul Bremer's 15% flat tax and put back into place a progressive income tax in Iraq? And how do you do away with his free trade policies and go back to a tariff-based trade policy that protects domestic manufacturers in Iraq so that Iraqis can go back to work making things, shoes and clothing for Iraqis, rather than having big transnational corporations import stuff for Iraqis that's being sold in the bazaars from China? I mean, they take these American politicians on these tours of the Iraqi bazaars, and what do they buy? Junk, or what's for sale? Junk made in China. And you wonder why the Iraqis are out of work. This is America writ large, in a way. Terrence in San Bernardino, California. Hey, Terrence, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, in all due respect, man, I think that your premise that you set up about San Francisco and Detroit left out some very important facts. Was either the governor or the mayor of those particular situations raping people, killing people? You know, Saddam wasn't just sitting there just being head of Iraq. You know, in all due respect, I think on the conservative side, you can say that he killed maybe 300,000 of his own people, let alone
because George Bush Sr. encouraged the uprising. I'm not defending Saddam, Terrence, pause for a minute. I'm not defending Saddam Hussein. That's why I started out with a hurricane or a tornado in Detroit and an earthquake in San Francisco. Saddam Hussein was gone when we finished the war. I'm talking about, how do you deal with an occupation? Now, Terrence, you want to come back and talk about that?
Okay, let's talk about the occupation. Let's move forward to that. So are you in any way implying that after World War II there were Nazis involved in the government?
Sure.
Did we bring Hitler's people back in to rebuild government, or did we decimate that government and start over?
No, there were a lot of Nazis involved. In fact, there were a lot of Nazis involved in the CIA. We recruited heavily from the Nazi, from the SS for the CIA.
Okay, and I may be wrong on that fact, but what I need to know.
I suggest you read the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
I will. I'll do that. I need to be educated on that, perhaps. But I will say this: the part that everybody's leaving out the equation is outside of Saudi Arabia, the first capital of the Islamic jihadist movement was in Baghdad. That's why it's so important.
No, it wasn't.
Yes,
no, it wasn't. Baghdad, Iraq. Terrence. Iraq was a secular society. Saddam Hussein hunted down and killed. You talk about he was torturing people. The people he was torturing were the people who were aligned with bin Laden. He hunted down and killed jihadis. He was suppressing jihad in Iraq. He hated them because they were a threat to his power.
You're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm saying bin Laden and the people who want to take over Iraq right now, that's coming out of Syria and Iran, they realize that historically, this is a historic battle for them. This has nothing to do with the...
They're not going to be able to take over Iraq. The Iraqis won't let them.
Well, tough.
Iraq has stood as an independent nation for 7,000 years, other than when they were occupied by the British unsuccessfully.
And they're going to
continue to.
Tom, that's not true.
That's exactly what's happening up in Anbar Province. 4 months before this so-called surge started, Terrence. By the way, in 2003, the tribal chieftains in Anbar came to us and said, "Listen, you guys, instead of us shooting at you, just let us deal with these Al Qaeda guys, these right-wing Muslim fundamentalists who think that they want to turn Iraq into something that looks like Afghanistan did with the Taliban. We will take them out." And our military said, and the Bush administration said, "No, we will not ally with you." And so for 3 years we fought them. And finally, 4 months before the surge began, we went to them and said, "Okay, we'll take you up on your deal." And we empowered them, and they started killing al-Qaeda and fighting al-Qaeda, the local guys who had converted to the crazy side in their own communities, and now the violence is down. And it's down because local control happened, not because of the surge. It had nothing to do with the surge. Terrence, you gotta read your history. I'm sorry. You just have to pay attention to what's actually going on there. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Sean in San Juan, Washington. Hey, Sean, we've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Okay, I'll get to you fast. I was listening to Stephanie Miller this morning. I heard two ads, and they were ads about joining Islam and how many Muslims were in the world. And here's a number that you can call to get a free copy of the Quran, as well as information. And I thought,
just like Christianity, Islam is an evangelical religion. You will not hear ads saying, join Judaism. But
I thought I was dreaming. I mean, I couldn't.
Well, you know, it's we've got. I mean, you know, remember those Koreans who got snatched in Afghanistan or Iraq? I forget which. And finally, they were released. They were there trying to spread Christianity. They're running around running ads saying, become Christian. It's like evangelical religions do that. I don't think that this was a call for jihad. You know, the vast majority of Muslims have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. And we have to get that through our heads, just like hopefully the rest of the Muslim world will get it through their head that the vast majority of Christians have nothing to do with crusades. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
There are people in this country who work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line.
Yeah, see, there you go. Your good union jobs. We outlawed unions in Iraq. Well, for that matter, we outlawed jobs by changing the laws so that any foreign corporation, particularly American contractors, could come into Iraq, set up shop, and bring in what in the United States would be referred to as illegal immigrants. In Iraq, they're not referred to as illegal immigrants because we changed their laws about that. Bring in labor from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and Pakistan, people who will work for nothing. Or not literally nothing, but, who will work for a whole lot less than the Iraqis will work for, who will, by the way, work for a whole lot less than the Americans. Jim in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I wonder if a new president could abrogate or cancel those American contractors' contracts in Iraq. I meant to ask Bernie this. I couldn't get on with him. Congress could. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I think that my guess is, my take on, and Jim, thanks for the call, my guess on, my take on what's going to happen here is that, in all probability, Bush is going to have at least 100,000 troops on the ground through the end of his presidency. He is going to succeed in handing this off to the next poor schlub who is president. That's what it's going to come down to. He's going to try and set it up so it doesn't go the way Nixon and Jerry Ford did. Nixon is remembered as the guy who lost Vietnam, but it was actually Jerry Ford who was president when those people were jumping off the top of the U.S. embassy in Saigon. But it was very shortly after Nixon left office. And Bush wants to make sure that it's at least a year or so after he leaves office before anybody winds the thing down so that any problems that are associated with it will not be blamed on him. I mean, he's as much as told his biographer this, you know, in this recent biography, Dead Certain. And I just, my sense of it is that he's going to have that that's what's going to happen, that, you know, and what just galls me, what I think is such a tragedy, is that we're asking the wrong question. And I think, frankly, if we get a Democrat in the White House and we have stronger Democratic control of the House and Senate, that there's a very high probability that something like the Marshall Plan will take place and that we will, you know, we will be able to rebuild Iraq in a way that will stop the violence. But as long as we continue it this way, nah. Herman in North Dakota. Hey, Herman, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay. You recommended the book, The Trap?
Yeah.
And I just finished the book, The Big Con.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells exactly the story you told this morning.
Yeah, it's the story of how U.S. contractors in Iraq, you know, well-connected Republican friends of the Bush administration were handed billions and billions, arguably, ultimately, possibly even trillions of dollars, but certainly hundreds of billions of dollars to rebuild Iraq. And we, the taxpayers, got ripped off, and the Iraqi workers got ripped off. And you wonder why they're out in the streets. You wonder why they're out in the streets. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff.
Hello, Tom. I am a member of the Sacred Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of southwestern Pennsylvania. We are a reformed and progressive Klan chapter. And my ranking officer,
you're kidding,
the Kliegel, asked me to please call and protest your insensitive, intolerant, and the hurtful language that was contained in your satire of Thursday, September 6th last week.
All right, what comedy troupe are you with, Jeff?
We have rejected hatred and racism. Our main concern is being opposed to the genocide of the human race, the genocide of all races, including the tragedy occurring in Darfur, global warming, pollution, many things.
Right.
And we're just asking you to strive to become more diverse in your views and learn to accept others who do not share
and to embrace the KKK. I love it, Jeff. Thank you very much. It's we should have had our. There we go. Baby, I'm crazy. But I still don't like the KKK. Baby, you're crazy. For being in the KKK. Baby, for even discussing the KKK. Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Dave in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to let you know why I'm going to D.C. on Saturday, why I'm meeting out front of the White House at noon and walking to the Capitol. It's because I learned recently in the, I guess from your show, probably, about the Nixon tapes, and which they talk about Nixon, like, staring out the White House window at the protesters in, what, 69?
Yeah, he had decided that he was going to drop nuclear bombs in Vietnam, and this million, literally million person demonstration in Washington, D.C. Caused him to change his mind. And we didn't learn about this until 20 years after the fact, but it actually caused him to change his mind.
Yeah, well, let's get on it, man.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree.
Let's
and if I wasn't going to be out of the country this weekend, I'd be there.
Right.
I think it's a fine thing.
3 hours away. My wife and I are going. We're bringing our dog, Cindy Sheehan, man. We're going, man.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, good on you, Dave, and I hope you have a great time there. Lee in Everett, Washington. Hey, Lee, got about a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
I'll make it quick. I'm just curious why no one really ever talks about who the war is against in Iraq. Who are we really fighting there? And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Well, you know, what's what do you mean? Oh, I guess Lee has hung up. Okay, thanks a lot, Lee. You know, again, this is the point that I made earlier. The people that were, quote, fighting, end quote, were the people who, in the weeks after the successful war and before the unsuccessful occupation began, were coming up to us and saying, thank you. And there, you know, there's no shortage of footage of it, and a lot of it wasn't faked. They were the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. They were the people who had average jobs. They were the people who were hoping that their country would get back to normal. They were the people who believed in civil governance. The problem is their country was taken over by a country, us, that is run by a cabal of neoconservatives and neoliberals who do not believe in democracy, who don't believe in governmental institutions, and who believe that ultimately the only thing that will solve all problems is the so-called free market run by so-called multi-transnational corporations. And it ain't worked out. 57 minutes past
the hour. The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, let's see. Don Rumsfeld says, Afghanistan has been a big success. Isn't that great? An interview with GQ magazine. Don Rumsfeld bragging about what the great success Afghanistan is. Even though it's really tragic, actually. Even though 20 Afghans were killed in two suicide bombings today. 69% increase in suicide bombings in Afghanistan by the Taliban. Second year in a row, largest opium production in the history of the world. Oh, yeah, it's a great success. And Petraeus saying that just in time for the November elections, by next summer, he'll be able to pull troop levels down to the pre-surge levels. Isn't that marvelous? It should be a nice little gift for the Republicans. Jim Dean on the line. Jim is the head honcho over at Democracy for America, democracyforamerica.com, the website. And I think that, Jim, your title is chair, actually. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on again.
Always great to have you with us, Jim. You're one of my absolute favorite people, and I love your political insights, and even more so, I love the fact that you're an activist. You're out there doing it. You're teaching people how to do it. You're doing a marvelous job. There's Democracy for America groups all over the country. You guys doing your trainings. Before we get into I'm curious your thoughts on Petraeus and the news of the day. But before we get into that, give us a quick update on what Democracy for America members are doing.
Well, right now, as you know, we're still involved in our training program. We just did a great training in Atlanta last weekend. We're going to be in Springfield, Illinois at the end of this month, September 29th. We've had about 13 to 14,000 people go through the program, and we're on our way to 25,000 by election 08 because we aim to be equipped and have all the tools that we need to change the tide and again, bring a decent government, bring good progressive people into office. So that's one thing, a big thing on us today. I mean, you know, we can talk about Gonzalez and the healthcare stuff, both of which we've been very, very involved with for some time. But, you know, we've been out right now trying to message people to call their congresspeople to fund the withdrawal and to get out of this war. And I hope everyone's going to get a pencil and a piece of paper out before, because before I get off, I want to make sure that everyone's got the number of the Capitol switchboard, because today, more than ever, our representatives in Congress, senators and congressmen really, really need to hear our support to withdraw the troops and get them out of Iraq. They need this political support badly. They're up against a big media machine, as you know, and we've really got to give them the strength and the power to get our troops home.
Right, and that number is 202-225-3121, unless you've got a better number.
I actually had 224-3121.
Yeah, either one works.
Okay, that's great.
Either one works. Yeah.
But definitely call and tell your family, friends, and neighbors to call.
Yeah, indeed. And democracyforamerica.com, I'm guessing you probably have that information over on your website as well. I have it at tomhartman.com also. If people didn't write it down, if they can remember Tom Hartman or if they can remember Democracy for America, it's foramerica.com, they can track it down. You guys delivered 7,742 healthcare horror stories to Congress.
Right. You know, we've been at this for a while. We got into it first starting to promote Michael Moore's film Sicko, which has been a huge success, and trying to do some political action around that in various places. We had, you know, several hundred, I think almost 1,000 people, for example, at one of his first showings, which was in Sacramento, right at the time when California legislature was starting to consider the two bills that I think they've got before them right now on health care. These, sort of like the movie, most of these stories, these 7,742 stories, are from people who have health insurance, Tom, who are supposedly covered, who are supposedly not the ones that are feeling the pain of our healthcare crisis. And in fact, what they point out so eloquently in so many ways is that this healthcare crisis is a crisis for all Americans, and that in fact it is in fact this in private insurance business system right now that is really the failure of this entire healthcare system. So we sorted those stories by congressional district, and we delivered them to approximately 319 individual members of Congress who, as you know, are on federal government health care plans, and they need to know the reality of what their constituents are living in, and we're hopeful that that's going to help spur them on to stop really this charade that somehow the private sector is going to make this all work just fine when the economy gets better or some other garbage like that. We really need to overhaul this system in a big way, and that's part of what we're doing, and we're going to be very actively involved in the states that are doing this, because we believe that when states pass this legislation, it'll give the members of Congress a little bit more guts, if you will, or courage to start doing this at the federal level. So, of course, we've got an opportunity to move the ball forward in California. I believe we have an opportunity to do that also in Pennsylvania, where I think a single-payer plan has been introduced in the legislature, and we're going to be looking for more of those around the country.
Jim, I'm curious if you've seen Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour.
I have not, actually.
I don't think I've pulled in a favor with you for years, but if as a personal favor to me, I would appreciate it if you would make an effort to see that movie in the next couple of days. I think that what you will find is a call to action very much like Sicko with Michael Moore that you may want Democracy for America to get involved with. And if you do, let me know personally, and I'll put you in touch with the people who made the movie and are promoting it.
All right, well, that's great. We're going to be doing a volunteer night here tonight, but I'm up here for about 4 or 5 days, so I'm going to try to go see that somewhere in Burlington as soon as I can.
Yeah, it's actually playing. There's going to be an opening in Burlington. Bernie Sanders is going to be there, in fact.
Oh, wow, opening. Okay.
So you know, I'm not sure exactly what the date or time is, but check it out. It's a mind-boggling movie. I don't say that just because I'm in it. It picks up where An Inconvenient Truth left off, and deals with the very real issues of our day, and the core call for action of the movie is political action. So I think it fits perfectly with what you're doing. But I'd love you to see it, and I'd love to have a conversation with you afterwards, if you don't mind.
Well, I sure will, and appreciate that. And, you know, obviously the key to changing all of this is citizen participation. It ain't going to get done if we don't do that.
Yep, absolutely. And that's the bottom line of that movie as well, and that's why they've got a website, 11thHourAction.com, also, that's doing something in some ways similar to what you're doing with Democracy. Well, no, it's not. You guys are doing trainings all over the country. You're doing amazing stuff. You have signed Democracy for America members, democracyforamerica.com. We're talking with Jim Dean, by the way, the chair of Democracy for America. Your members have signed over 100,000 petitions calling for Gonzalez to go. He's gone. Now what?
Well, we got to get somebody in there that's going to restore the integrity of the Justice Department. And, in my travels, I've run into several people, a number of people, actually, who work as attorneys in the Justice Department. And what they've said in the press about the morale, the low morale in that department is absolutely true. They've never been more embarrassed by the politicization of what is a very, very key, obviously the key law enforcement tool that the federal government has. So we really need to get somebody in here who's going to get rid of all of that, and to start, hiring real people who are really, in pursuit of things, you know, the ideals that we have that they're supposed to do, which is, you know, enforcing civil rights laws, and enforcing protections for taxpayers, and voters in this country. So, you know, that's a tough road to hoe. I hear a lot of names that are being mentioned out there. Some folks in Connecticut were very enamored with the idea of Senator Lieberman becoming a Justice Department so we could get a new senator. But nonetheless.
But that would be a Republican senator.
Well, most likely it would be, but in Connecticut, as bad as people think in our state. Most Republicans in the state of Connecticut want us to get out of Iraq right now. So.
Oh, interesting. You live in Connecticut?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I didn't know that.
No, nonetheless, it's really going to be about integrity, about nonpartisanship, and about somebody who's really, really committed to restoring this department to where it's got to be for it to work.
Yeah. We're talking with Jim Dean, democracyforamerica.com, the website. Jim, we started our conversation. We only have a minute left here. We started our conversation with the situation in Iraq, and you said please call Congress at 202-225-3121 or 224-3121 and let your elected officials know that you want us, you want our troops out of Iraq. Do you think that the most effective way to have this happen is to simply refuse to vote for any more funding for the war?
Well,
it seems like, you know, without a veto-proof majority, the only power that the Democrats have right now is to not act. They can't be proactive.
Well, yes, I do. I think, you know, this is a situation where you know, everybody supports the troops and wants them to be safe, but we can't support a chief executive who has failed so badly at this.
But even Joe Biden yesterday on Meet the Press was saying, I will vote for additional money for the troops so that they can have these Cougar armored Humvee thingy contraptions. You know, I mean, it's like the Democrats are already wussing out on this thing. They're saying that they're going to vote for the money.
Well, I think the issue of defunding, again, I turn it around. I think it's time to start voting for funding that specifically for bringing our troops home. I mean, that's going to cost a lot of money.
That has timelines. But see, that won't pass a filibuster and it won't pass a veto.
We won't know unless we try, Tom.
Well, you're absolutely right, Jim. And thank you for bringing me back to common sense. You're absolutely right.
All right.
Jim Dean, democracyforamerica.com. Check it out. Get involved. Participate. This is one of the greatest organizations in America. Jim Dean, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on.
Yep. And let me know when you've seen 11th Hour.
I sure will.
Okay, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's getting strange out there. I'll tell you, it's getting very strange. Not just David Petraeus' testimony, but get this. In Georgia, a McDonald's employee spent a night in jail and is facing criminal charges because a police officer's burger was too salty. Poor Kendra Bull. She was arrested Friday, charged with misdemeanor reckless conduct. She said she accidentally spilled salt on some hamburger meat. She told her supervisor and a coworker they tried to thump the salt off it. It got made into hamburgers. On her break, she said she ate a burger made with the salty meat. She said it didn't make me sick. But then police officer Wendell Adams got a burger made with the oversalted meat, and he returned a short time later and told the manager it made him sick. Bull admitted spilling salt on the meat, and Adams took her outside and questioned her. If it was too salty, she says, why didn't he take one bite and throw it away? But he's saying it made him sick, and she's in jail. Ain't life strange? George in North Carolina. Hey, George, welcome to the program. Hey, George. No, George. Carl in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hey, I have to read you a letter.
I'm sorry, but you can't. One of the few rules we have in this program is that people don't read things when they call in. If you want to tell me something or if you want to discuss something, fine, but no reading.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, I'm so nervous. Sorry.
It's okay.
Blog is carlbond.blogspot.com, and it's an open letter to the leaders of the world, and I just believe that everyone should read it.
Okay, great. Got your message out, and I hope some folks check it out. Thanks a lot, Carl. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart.
Yeah, Tom, I caught you once again framing an issue the way the Roe v. would want us to frame it, something all of us progressives do now and again, but we end up serving the very people who we are trying to struggle against. You referred to the money that goes to the operations in Iraq, to the war profiteers mostly in Iraq, as money for the troops. The money has never gone to the troops. If it did, they would all be millionaires, and they certainly would have the best equipment they could ever have in the world.
But, yeah, you're absolutely right, Stuart. And in fact, the troops are paid by, you know, salaries that come out of the Department of Defense budget, not out of these special appropriations. This is all going to the contractors and the support. Support operations, or most of it is going to the contractors and support operations. But I believe if you're referring to what I think you are, is when I was quoting Joe Biden, who was on Meet the Press yesterday. And Joe Biden was, you know, and what I said was, this is going to be characterized as money to support the troops, and that the Democrats are lining themselves up, that they're going to be afraid to vote in a way that's not going to be viewed as supporting the troops. And Biden really made that clear when he talked about how, you know, he was over there and he had these soldiers take him over and show him this new Cougar contraption, this armored vehicle that drove over 250 pounds of TNT and was blown as high as a telephone pole. And when it came down, all the guys inside survived. And he said the troops, their lives just light up when they see that. And he said, so there's no way I'm going to vote against the money for that. He said, this meme is just so powerful. I mean, when you hear Joe Biden, who's, I think, otherwise generally a relatively rational Democrat, and certainly an opponent of the ongoing occupation of this war, talking about that, you, in my opinion, you know, the war of words is lost.
Well, maybe I misheard you, but I didn't get the part where you were clearly quoting Joe Biden. It sounded like you were using their language as we so often inadvertently do.
It may have been, Stuart, and thanks for keeping me honest. I appreciate it. Crystal in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Crystal.
Hi there. Hi, Tom. I wanted to refer back to the call that you got in the second hour, third segment, and it was right at the end, and I didn't really get to hear what she was going to say, but she was complaining, I think, about an advertisement on her local affiliate, Air America affiliate, and for Muslim, I guess, prostitutes.
Right. If you want to learn more about Islam, call this number and we'll send you a Quran or something like that.
Yeah. And I just think it's a sad day when this, you know, when we listeners of a progressive talk station are more concerned about something like that. You know, and there's plenty of atheist ads on ours on KPOJ. Well, we're more concerned about that than we are at, like, Bechtel advertising. We have plenty of corporate sponsors here, and Bechtel was recently advertising in Portland, and no one called about that.
Yeah, yeah, and then you see – good point, Crystal, thank you. And then you see things like the ads on the big network news shows for weapons manufacturers, jet aircraft, oil drilling rigs. You think that's because they want you to buy an oil drilling rig after you finish watching the evening news? I don't think so. I think it's a way of funneling money to the big media machines to keep them from being critical of them. And as to the atheism ads, I would submit to you that evangelical atheism is a religion every bit as much as evangelical anything else. Paul in Clifton, New Jersey, listening to WWRL. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Tom, I wanted to ask you about libertarians.
Sure.
You sort of dismiss them with a contemptuous slogan. Are there libertarians of different gradations, or are they all exactly the same? Because I like Ron Paul, what I've heard from him so far.
Yeah, Ron Paul's a guy of integrity who speaks the truth on a lot of issues. And as a libertarian, and I say this 25 years ago, as a person who at 25 years ago called himself a libertarian. And so I have some, you know, I've been to libertarian meetings, I've read libertarian literature for decades, and I have, I think, considerable familiarity with libertarian point of view. The worldview of libertarians is that the only role for government is essentially the military role. And if Ron Paul were president, or any other libertarian, and I think right across the board, because their philosophy is quite clear, it's quite stark, it's quite black and white, and it's quite inflexible. If he were president, you would have no public schools, you would have privatized fire departments, you would have privatized public roads, it would be turned into toll roads, you would have no Social Security, it would be privatized, you would have no possibility of any sort of help for medical expenses, no Medicare, no Medicaid, you would have no programs for poverty, period. You would have the federal government involved in basically nothing except, you know, waging wars and running police departments.
Could you possibly get him on your station?
Oh, he's been on this program three or four times in the last 5 years. He hasn't come on since he's been running for president.
He was on Randy Rhodes a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, he's speaking out of a place of integrity. He actually believes this stuff, even though there has never in the history of the world been a country that has been run on libertarian principles that worked. It would devolve, in my opinion, into a Lord of the Flies kind of situation. But, you know, he actually believes this stuff, and he does speak, you know, truth to power, in particular in the Republican Party, even though he ran as a libertarian for president, 4 years ago or 8 years ago. But in any case, he does speak truth to power about what's going on in Iraq, and I salute him for that. And frankly, I salute him for having the conviction of his opinions. As I said, he's been on this program before.
Some of his answers I thought were, you know, reasonable anyhow. I don't think he would disregard the Constitution.
Well, see, the problem is, what does the Constitution mean? The Constitution, you know, pretty clearly lays out that, for example, in the preamble, that one of the primary purposes of government is to provide for the welfare of the people. What does that mean? Lyndon Johnson thought that meant that the government should have a play a role in dealing with those who are the least among us, to paraphrase Jesus. And he cut poverty in half in the United States in just 4 years. Ron Paul would say, no, that the government has no role doing that. The welfare clause does not mean welfare programs. And, you know, it's like, so we can all agree that we think that the Constitution is a fine thing. The devil's in the details when you start parsing out what does the Constitution mean. You know, Ron Paul would say that he doesn't see those, you know, basically that if we go back to the way the government was functioning in 1796 or 1798 or 1789 when the Constitution was ratified, that should be the beginning and end of everything that we do. And I would say, you know, times have changed and we need to redefine those things. But Paul, you know, good point. We'll continue to try and get Ron Paul on the program. He's been a good guest in the past when we've just talked about libertarian issues. And we'll see what happens. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi. Well, I'll get better when we get back our country.
There you go. We all will.
You know, in regards to Petraeus, this didn't slip past me that he gets to the U.S., you know, and is able to collude with the Bush administration to, you know, write out his report, you know, in the safety of the U.S. And by the way, you know, I'm in this position of I can't afford very much, you know. How about a quid pro quo? I'd like to see the movie The 11th Hour, and I've always wanted your book, Screwed.
go to the public library for the book, and I'm guessing that the movie will be out in DVD probably within 6 months or so, and you can get that at the public library as well. Yeah, I mean it's pretty that. But now, if Ron Paul had his way, there would be no public libraries. Because libertarians don't believe we should have public libraries. They think Ben Franklin's idea was socialist, that we the people would collectively get together and say there are these things called the commons, and one of those commons is information. In fact, this is why Alberto Gonzalez's parting shot leaving the Department of Justice was to have the Department of Justice issue not an order, but an opinion, I guess would be the word, saying that the ongoing and increasing privatization of the web is a good thing, and that companies should be able to just, in other words, blowing away net neutrality. This is now the position of the Justice Department, and frankly, it needs to be reversed. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Generally speaking, welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Wendy Wang with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Wendy, what's happening today in Washington?
Hey there, Tom. I'm actually standing outside the committee hearing room in the Cannon Building, where the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committee on the House side is hearing testimony from General Petraeus and also from Ambassador Crocker. They're, of course, giving us an assessment of how the situation is going in Iraq. And let me tell you, it's been a very traumatic morning so far.
How so?
Well, first of all, the mic on the general and the ambassador's seat all went out for about 5 minutes. They couldn't get the audio system to come back on. Then we had lights flickering in the room, and this all, of course, add to kind of the drama that really kind of infiltrated the room here. And Code Pink, the group of mothers who are protesting the war, stood up on numerous occasions and shouted that Petraeus is, of course, lying to the American people. Now, I should take a step back and say that MoveOn.org this morning took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post, the New York Times, saying, of course, that Petraeus will be lying to the American people because his assessment that things are going well with the surge is misleading. In fact, they call him General Betray Us, a play on his name. And the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee, Duncan Hunter, called attention to that article or to that ad, and he, of course, asked that Democrats and Republicans join together to denounce the intent behind that ad. Of course, he's saying that the general is a very reputable man and he's done so much for the troops so far, and we need to stand behind him and look at it from a very constructive way. And he, of course, welcomed the general to the joint committee. But, you know, the Democrats aren't about to let that one go.
Yeah. Well, now, the New York Times headline today, slow progress being made in Iraq, Petraeus tells Congress, and that by next summer, he says, the U.S. should be able to reduce its troop strength in Iraq to the level it was before the recent increase. So we'll slow things down by next summer just in time for the fall elections. Is this a gift to the Republicans that Petraeus is talking about? Is that what this guy is doing? Is he's just sucking up the Bush to get another star and another star? I mean, he's gotten two now, during the time that he's been, in my opinion, a toady for the Bush administration. Or am I being too harsh?
You know, Tom, it's all about theater in this committee hearing from the very beginning. We were told, of course, that Petraeus won't be giving out his written statement in the beginning because he wanted to say in his opening statement that no one has seen what he's about to say, and that the White House had no hand in the report that he issued out to Congress. So from the very beginning, it felt like we were being led into a theater of sorts, and given like the theatrics of it all, we're really questioning the timing of just about everything, the positioning of the charts and graphs so far across the room from where the media is sitting that we can't even see the numbers on it. And of course, all this information was withheld from us until after he had given his statement, his testimony, so that there's no way for us to follow along what he's actually telling us. So, you know, for you to say that perhaps the troops will be taken out over the summer right before the general election, it falls under the whole theatrics, I believe.
Congressman Lantos said to Petraeus, the administration has sent you here today to convince us that victory is at hand. With all due respect, sir, I don't buy it. How did Petraeus respond? How is he reacting to this hostile reception he's getting from some of the Democrats?
You know, I was sitting right behind Petraeus, but the camera panned over to him, and I was watching his facial expression. He was, of course, very stoic, as always, being a military man. But there was a lot of gasps in the audience, and I think a lot of small cheering going on underneath the underlying current. It's hard to gauge just, you know, what the general reaction would be out there as we're kind of in this little, well, not exactly a little room, but a enormous committee caucus room. But, you know, I think that a lot of people did feel that Lantos hit it on the spot several times, including saying how this administration really lost faith and that it wasn't Petraeus himself who really made it so, but that this administration leading into all of this really made us feel as if they are going to be lying to us. Now, Lantos, of course, recalled a conversation he had with General Petraeus back in 2003 where they were touring parts of northern Iraq, and Petraeus had said to Lantos that he is short of men and that he doesn't have enough personnel, troops, whatnot. And he, and Petraeus, according to Lanto, said that one day we are going to rue the day that we set these motions into place. And he, of course, asked Petraeus to address that. In his opening remarks, Petraeus didn't. And I'm going to head back into the hearing room here in a little bit, and hopefully it'll be Lanto's turn to really engage him, Petraeus, that is, in more of this conversation.
So Petraeus didn't confirm that he had said that to Lantos? He didn't, he danced around it, or?
That was said during the opening remarks, so there wasn't an opportunity for General Petraeus to actually respond to Lantos.
Oh, I see. This was the opening remarks by members of Congress.
Exactly.
Yeah, very interesting. And this, his testimony today, is it just going to be limited to today, or is it going to continue tomorrow?
Well, this particular committee hearing might actually run into tomorrow because they were stopped several times due to technical difficulties, like I mentioned to you earlier, with the audio equipment going out and being interrupted several times by protesters. But tomorrow he is due to speak for the Senate committees both in the morning and the afternoon.
Yeah, okay, that was my recollection. But thank you. Thank you for that, Wendy Wang, and for the report from Washington, D.C. Good luck, and listen carefully. thank you so much. Coming up tomorrow, Martha Stout will be talking about the paranoia switch. It's 9/11. How terror rewires our brains, reshapes our behavior, and how we can reclaim our courage. Ralph Nader will be here. I'm calling President Bush to select a new attorney general who respects the Constitution, plus your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.